Welcome to the arena where sometimes the hardest part is showing up. My name is Linda McLaughlin. Thank you for being here. My guest, Anne Boekma, has been an inspiration to me since I read her memoir long before I met her. In the fall of 2021, I took her writing workshop, and thanks to her guidance, I wrote and shared an intensely personal story through her six-minute memoir workshop and storytelling event. For context, we recorded this conversation in late 2021 while the COVID Omicron variant still raged. Before we begin, I acknowledge that I record this podcast on the First Nations territories of the Erie, Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, Mississaugas, and the Chonodon of the so-called Neutral Tribes. Hamilton is also adjacent to the Haldimand Treaty Territory. Thank you for being here. This is episode 51. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a part of my podcast, Anne. I'm delighted to have this conversation. You've been on my list for quite some time, and thank you for the book that you wrote, because it came to me at a time when it was important for me to hear some of the lessons and learnings and inspiration, frankly, that you shared through your book. So thank you for that. And I thought you would be a perfect addition to the podcast. So
yeah, thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I have an introduction that I've cobbled together based on what I know of you, what I've read, and what I've learned. So why don't I throw that out, and then we can get into a conversation from there. Anne Boekma, you are a daughter, sister, and mother. You're an award-winning journalist, writing coach, workshop leader, and author. You're also the founder of Hamilton's popular six-minute memoir, a live storytelling event, which has also become a podcast. Growing up in a fundamentalist sect, the Canadian Reformed Church, your world was extremely narrow. There were lots of taboos. Certainly, dancing and Canadian boys were off the table. And when you went off to journalism school, you were suddenly exposed to different points of view, religions, and ways of being. So at 20 years old, you made the painful decision to leave your church, even though you were threatened with excommunication and burning in hell. You ultimately chose to leave, which created a rift between you and your family. Fast forward, you were a mother and wife. Your children were about to leave home, and you found yourself in a bit of a midlife crisis. You were at a pretty low ebb. Your journalistic curiosity and spiritual longing prompted exploration of a growing movement called Spiritual But Not Religious. You started a blog and began to explore 24 different spiritual practices over the course of a year, from goat yoga and forest bathing to a gratitude practice and hallucinogenics. From there, you wrote your memoir, My Year of Living Spiritually, One Woman's Secular Quest for a More Soulful Life. It's a wonderful, funny, insightful, and touching book that I devoured as I was going through the radical changes in my own life. Welcome to the arena, Anne.
Thank you so much, Linda, for that thoughtful and well put together introduction. I'm really humbled. Thank you.
You're welcome. I grew up in a French Canadian Roman Catholic household, and we went to church every Sunday. And I, as a young person, went kicking and screaming. And frankly, my family stopped going after I moved away from home. So I think they were just trying to make sure that I went to church. But I related to that questioning of, is this all there is, or is this really the way to see the world through this particular lens? And then that exploration of various practices and ways of finding a spiritual path for myself. And I think certainly there's a lot of people who are on that journey, having either had a religious upbringing and now having left that and now finding their own way.
Yeah, I think many of us were raised in a religious environment, especially those of us of a certain age, over 50. Church life or religious life was often part of our experience in our families. It's not something we had a choice over. It was something that we were born into. And I think many of us, as we got older, became quite disillusioned with religion. For some of us, it's easy to leave. If you're Anglican or United or a moderate Catholic and you stop going to services, it's not that big a deal. For others, it's a huge deal. I was raised Canadian Reformed. I went to church twice on Sunday, private Christian schools. My entire community was Dutch. Catechism classes, young people's, I mean, everything revolved around religion. And it's the same for some other people, strict Baptists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Orthodox Jews. Every religion has its fundamentalist sect, and it's very difficult for people like that to leave. I know I found that to be true. And when you leave, you lose your family often in those kind of religious sects or denominations. And that is what makes a lot of people stay, is they cannot face the prospect of losing their family. And that is very difficult. And it was certainly for me for decades. When I wrote my book, I had been estranged from my family for a decade over religion. So there is a lot of pain in leaving when you cannot be accepted for who you are. I left the Canadian Reformed Church and went to the United Church. I still went to church. I still go to church today. I eventually became a Unitarian 15 years ago, which is a very liberal, open religion. The Bible is not the main book. We have a book of readings and so on. But for me, Sunday services, there was a comfort in that, in being part of a tribe. And I'm fortunate to have that in the Unitarian Church, where I always say I don't have to lift the heavy weight of dogma to be part of this community that's really focused more on social justice and making the most of the one life we know for sure, which is the one on this earth.
It's an interesting way of putting it, the one life we know for sure.
Yeah, I think one of my theories, and it's not original to me, is that religion was created by men mostly because we couldn't face the idea of death. We needed to believe that there is going to be something beyond this life that we have. There must be something else. And I think that's a big part of what religion offers, is that comfort that this is not all there is. There has to be a better life. There's going to be a heaven, streets of gold, and all of that. And there's nothing wrong with believing in that. I don't believe in that. There's nothing wrong with having hope that there might be some grand hereafter. But to my mind, all we know for sure is today and this life. So let's focus on this life and not the afterlife, not some golden payoff if we're good. And I think a lot of religion uses fear of hell, fear of the rapture, fear of the devil, all of those fears that we're taught as children, many of us, and guilt to keep people in religion. And that was one of the things I wanted to explore, is once you get away from a religion that can be oppressive or that doesn't work for you, does that mean you have to throw it all out? Or is there a way to experience spirituality, whether through rituals or practices or a different approach to life? And I do think religion and spirituality are two quite different things.
Take me back to growing up in your household. What was dinner conversation like growing up for you?
I was born to teenage parents. They got married, and then I was born a year later. And my mother was 17 when she got married, and my dad was 19, and they were in the Canadian Reformed Church. And then my mother had a son, my brother, and my father, who was a troubled person, left our family when I was just 3 years old and my brother was a baby. And that was really a defining event in my life. I later learned that he had bipolar disorder and had troubles in his life and drinking, but he really just left. And my mom brought up myself and my brother for 6 years before she remarried, and she was quite poor. She was on welfare. We didn't have a car or a television. We lived very simply, and yet I love my mother, and I never felt deprived because she was a very loving mother. And then when I was 9, she remarried. I got a stepfather, and he was a great provider, very loving to my mom. He and I were not particularly close, but he was there for us in every way. And growing up, when I was a teenager and started to have my own views of things, we always had raucous dinner hours. My mom was a beautiful cook. We always ate together as a family. They went on to have 2 other children, so there were 4 siblings in the family. And dinner was an hour or an hour and a half, always talking about our day. My father was very conservative, always talked about political events. And as I got older and went to college and started to have opinions on my own, there were quite a few arguments around the dinner table. And I think that was a good thing. By and large, they were not horrible screaming matches or anything, just a free discussion of ideas. And I think that really helped me form my own opinions. But when I started to become much more liberal and question things, then difficulty did start. I left home when I was 19. I went to journalism school and got my first job. And I left the church shortly after I moved out. And this caused a huge issue in my family. My mother was just devastated. The elders of that church would come knocking on my door. I wrote about this in my book. They sent me a letter saying my soul was barred from the gates of heaven. And I just saw how oppressive that church really was. I was dating a Catholic, and they said, don't even bother bringing him to our church. He won't fit in. And I got married to Jeff, and my parents were so upset. I remember my mom saying, I will never be happy again if you marry a Catholic. And they weren't going to come to the wedding. Yeah, I mean, it's so funny with Catholics, because of the one religious group that I was really raised to have a bias against, it wasn't the Jews who don't believe in Christ or other religions. It was the Catholics who essentially believe what my family believed, that there's a God in heaven, that there's a heaven and hell, Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And yet I was raised to have a real distrust for Catholics. And this all goes back to being Dutch and the Reformation in Holland 500 years ago. Talk about carrying a grudge. And it was a very big deal to marry Catholic, even though my husband at the time was not practicing. And he continued to go to church after his family left. But anyway, my parents were not going to come to the wedding. It was very fraught. They did end up coming to the wedding. And we had a sort of uneasy truce for years. I remember when I had my girls baptized in the United Church, I remember my mother crying. And I didn't feel they were tears of joy. And I felt she was concerned that I would go to hell and that my children would go to hell. And eventually when I became a Unitarian about 13 years ago, I kept it from my parents. They still thought I was going to the United Church, and I never told them because I knew they would be very disapproving. And one day when my young daughter, she was about 7, Ruby, was visiting, we were visiting my mother, and I was out of the room for a minute. My mother said to her, do you still go to the United Church? And Ruby said, oh no, we're Unitarian now. We never talk about Jesus.
Oh no.
And I will tell you, there was a mighty scene at my folks' house. My parents were pacing the floor. Oh. They looked up Unitarianism. They thought it was a cult, even though it's one of the most respected and oldest religions in North America. They were so disappointed and disgusted with me. And on the way home, I just wept the whole hour ride home. And the next day I realized I need therapy. And I was fortunate to see someone for a couple years. And I remember that first appointment, I said, I need to separate from my parents. It's not healthy for me. And so I did that. I tried to do it in a loving way. And that began a long period of estrangement until my stepfather died 3 years ago, and I went to the funeral, and then I went to visit my mom, and slowly we have built our relationship miraculously back to where it was. And all that it took was for her to say, sometimes we have to agree to disagree, which was all I ever asked. I didn't try to change their opinion or criticize their religion. I just didn't want them to criticize me. So I am 60, I'm going to be 60. My mother's going to be 78. And I am so grateful that we reconciled, because it was a weight on me. I was very close to my mom when I was young. And it just goes to show you never do know what could happen. People can change. And I think my father's death showed her how finite life is and that we don't have forever. And I think reading my book too, she did read my book where I lay all this out, the good and the bad and the ugly. And she's never said whether she's liked my book or disliked it. But after I gave her the manuscript before it was published, because she figures so prominently in it, I felt I owed it to her to allow her to read it. Mm-hmm. She called me the next day and she corrected a couple of facts. And then she said, I love you. And I had not heard that in about 20 years. So I think those two events combined helped us get back on track. And we have a very loving relationship today. And I'm so thankful for that.
You're very fortunate that she was able to and prepared to step up to the plate with that sharing of her new perspective or her willingness to step down from the position that she and her husband had taken. That's a very challenging thing to do.
Yeah, and not everyone in that church would do that. And I have a list of resources in the back of my book for people who are trying to leave religion, whether they're Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses or fundamentalist Christians, because you do need support when you leave, because you can be cast out into the wilderness. And one of the reasons I wanted to write my book was to offer some sort of hope to other people who have been through this trauma of losing their family, and even for some losing their religion. Religion does provide a great comfort to many people. And so I hoped it would help them or inspire them. And it's been so gratifying to hear from so many strangers who have been through a similar experience. And there is such a thing as religious trauma syndrome. I write about that a bit in my book. And Dr. Marlene Winnell in San Francisco coined the term, and her specialty psychotherapy practice is exclusively focused on people who have suffered religious trauma from the religions that they were raised in and from the rejection of parents and of their church community or their religious community, I should say, because it's not just Christianity. It's Judaism, Islam, all religions have a very fundamentalist sect to them. Some have a liberal bent on things like the United Church, and some have a very fundamentalist aspect. And those religions are very difficult to leave. And that's why there's things like excommunication and shunning, which is the worst possible. Our greatest fear in life is to be rejected. To be rejected by those we love, to be alone. That's what excommunication and shunning is designed to do. And studies show that so many people stay in their religion because they're afraid of just that. They'd rather go to services, take the good that they can get out of it, disbelieve the rest, and not lose their community. Because it is hard to find community in this world. And people who are spiritual but not religious, that's one of their greatest challenges, is they don't have a house of worship to go to. So they have to create community. And that can happen in lots of different kinds of ways, which I explore in my book. But religion provides an instant community of belonging. But waver or don't agree with it all, that's when the problems can start. And that's what I certainly discovered.
I think my challenge with religion, and I believe you've spoken of that as well, that religion, in my mind, is handing your spirituality to someone else to determine what that means, what it looks like, what to believe, etc. Whereas spirituality is a much more personal thing. And notwithstanding the lack of community, as you were just saying, but that's where I really have an issue with organized religion, is that more often than not, it's a man that is determining what the rules are and what is allowed and what's not allowed. And it's not that necessarily the scripture was originally written in a particular way. It's the interpretation that an individual is now bringing to what all of those words mean. And that's the part that just made me crazy as a young person, beginning to know myself and to develop my own opinions and my own view of the world. And as you begin to do that, you're breaking away sometimes from the way that you've been taught to to think. And
so true what you say. I totally agree. And people ask me, what's the difference between spirituality and religion? And I, similar to you, I believe that religion is from the outside, an outside authority telling us how we should live, whether that's a Bible or a book or the Quran or some minister, usually a man. You know, religion's been very patriarchal. Where spirituality is within, you know, our inner guide, our conscience, our own reading. You know, Emerson has this great quote about make your own Bible. And my Bible is nature and the poetry of Mary Oliver and being in communion with friends and music and trying to be some sort of good force in the world. So make your own Bible. I really believe that. And religion has been, dare I say, a primarily destructive force in the world. Wars, you know, just the idea of holy wars, a hatred of other people because they don't believe the way we do. I was raised in the Canadian Reformed Church, which many of your listeners probably have never heard of, 10 or 15,000 people in Canada. I was raised to believe we were the only true church. And everyone else, certainly Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, and Hindus, certainly they were all going to hell. That is a ridiculous concept. And yet when you are a child and the people you love the most in the world and the church that you've been going to since you were baptized tells you this or brainwashes you into believing this, until you are exposed to other ideas, which I thankfully was by going to a public high school finally and to college. This is why many fundamentalist religions don't want you to be educated, especially women. The scales will fall from your eyes and the brainwashing will dissipate. So I love the aspect of religion where it brings people together in community. I love singing, the singing aspect. But I think there can be other ways that we can have that without all the fear and guilt that goes along with it. And we just to look at all these religious scandals and the obsession with sex, the priests not getting married, sexual abuse in all these churches, keeping women down, being anti-choice. Why this obsession with sex that so many religions have? Why not have an obsession with lying? Or stealing, or you know what I mean? Religion has been really used to suppress a sexuality, and I think it comes out in unhealthy ways often, and especially to suppress female sexuality, I would say. So yeah, those are some of my views about religion. I'm anti-dogma, not anti-religion. I understand the comforts of religion. Also think, let's be pro-spirituality and explore, you know, church services is usually an hour a week. Why can't we encompass more spirituality in our lives on a daily basis? There's lots of ways to do that.
What event in your life has had the most profound impact on you?
What event in my life has had the most profound impact on me? I would say the most positive impact was having children. I was married for 14 years before we had children. We were very much opposed to the idea of having children. We were childless by choice. We felt the world was overpopulated, that it was almost egotistical to have children. We were very firm in our belief on this until I turned 34 and I woke up one day and it's like, I want a baby now. So I do believe in the biological clock because it's my intellect. I had a craving to have a baby. It was unbelievable to me. And fortunately, I did have one when I was 35, and Ruby, who is now 25. And 3 years later, I had Lucy, who's now 21. And being a mother was terrifying and wonderful. And now they are grown women and they are the great joy of my life. That has had a huge impact. I would say on the challenging side, what I referred to earlier, my biological father leaving when I was 3 had a huge impact on my life in terms of financial, had a huge impact on my mother financially. She's quite poor.
Were you ever reunited with him or reconnected with him?
No. He left my mother one day. He took his lunch pail. He was a laborer and he took his lunch pail one day and he just left and he didn't come back for a year. He didn't tell her where he was. He just left. my poor mother. And my mother was in love with him. You know, it was like a teenage, you know. He came back a couple of times. He did want to have visiting rights to see us. So there was a court case. Mother didn't want him to see us, I believe, and I had to go up on the stand when I was 5 years old. I still remember that. And he won visiting rights to come and see us. He had to pay $100 a month child support. This was in late 1960s. And his first court check bounced, and he only came to see us twice, my brother and I, and then I never saw him again. But he, I think in his mind, he had left the church. He'd been brought up, you know, I'd heard that his father had been abusive to him. He had no education. He did have bipolar disorder, which was discovered later in life. And of course, no treatment back then. Mm-hmm. He was a very troubled person. He traveled around. He was a bit of a hobo. He married a couple of other times. When I was 50, I found out about a brother that I had through him. And he died when he was only 47 of a heart attack. And he had been living in a homeless shelter for a while. I mean, it's a very sad story. And growing up without a father, I think, I'm not exactly sure of the impact it had on me, but it did have an impact. And
definitely.
Yeah. And if he had stayed, I can't say life would have been better, because he was very troubled and he was a drinker and he was not kind to my mom. And I could have grown up in a home that was very challenging instead of having a peaceful home with my mother. It's just unfortunate what happened. And then I would say the impact of my life was getting separated 3 years ago. You know, I was for 32 years and expected to be married forever. And things happen as they do in some marriages that tore us apart. And that was extremely painful. When I went on this journey to write this book, and engaged in 24 different spiritual practices and look back on my life and examine things, I really see now that I was trying to find answers to my relationship with my mother and my marriage. I was on a path to determine should the marriage end or stay. And writing this book helped me figure things out. And the marriage ended. But the good thing is we were able to end the marriage in a loving way. And for our daughter's sake and for our own, and not have resentments. And I think we've really had an ideal separation. My ex still comes by and we share the dog, celebrate our children's birthdays together, really try to have a very amicable separation. And he is still a good friend. It's not easy to do, but when you have children, unless there's abuse or addiction or something horrible, it really is so helpful for them to see the two people that they love try their best to get along and to forgive. So yeah, those are the three key things in my life that have had the impact. It's a good question. Really makes you think.
And what does living a courageous life mean to you?
I think living a courageous life means trying to be as authentic as possible. Trying to be true to yourself. I know that sounds trite, but, you know, I had somebody say to me a while ago about my separation, because we are quite friendly, and someone said, well, you're either separated and don't see each other, or you should get back together. And in terms of
what?
Yeah, like they find it odd, right, that we're still so friendly. And to me, it's like, you know, to be courageous, I don't really care what other people think. I spent a lot of time worrying about that when I was younger. I don't care what other people think. The relationship I have with my ex is unique and I'm proud of it. And it's nobody else's business. So that's what being true to yourself is, I think, is not really caring. Yeah, caring and kind, but you have a right to live your life in the best way possible that works for you. And being brave, you know, I like to think that I am a brave person. When I left the church, there was so much pressure. My life would have been so much easier if I had just stayed. Even if I had brought Jeff along, he would have come to church with me. We could have sat there for an hour on Sundays. But I couldn't live with myself if I did that. And so I had to be brave. And I was 21 years old and I went to see the minister, and he was trying to talk me into staying and putting fear in me and the fear of hell and losing my entire community and quoting the Bible at me. And I just quoted it right back to him. I do know my Bible. That's the one category I'm good at. I'm Jeopardy. And you know, when I asked him, I challenged him, because of course women in that church were not allowed to have any leadership position whatsoever. And when I told him that was one of the reasons I was leaving, he pointed to some Bible verses that said women had to keep their heads covered in church, not speak, and they should not be an authority. But, you know, there's plenty of other verses in the Bible that we don't follow anymore, like what kind of food to eat and what kind of cloth to wear. And when I challenged him about that, he was like, that cultural tradition of the time. Well, who decides what's a cultural tradition and who decides what's a rule that we are going to keep thousands of years later? The patriarchy's best interest not to allow women to lead, and their views on gays and all of that. And so being courageous means you're going to piss some people off. And you have to learn to live with that. I was involved in a protest in Hamilton when Bill Cosby came to town. I write about this in my book as well. At the time, 30 women had accused, this was 2015, 30 women had accused him of sexual assault. Eventually, the number grew to 60. And I helped organize an indoor protest during a show. 30 of us got tickets. We sat in the auditorium. We rose up 15 minutes into the show chanting, "We believe the women." We blew rape whistles. We were escorted out by police, but we did disrupt his show. And I had people emailing me, men, saying they wanted to punch me out, that I was an idiot, that I should go to Afghanistan where women really are treated badly. Someone posted my email address. I got hate mail. I didn't give a shit what those people thought. Sometimes when you know you're doing something right, you are so determined in your view of it and you don't care what other people think. And I think that's part of being courageous, is to have the ability to let other people down so that you can live your truth. And believe me, I did not want to let my mother down. I adored my mother. She had such a difficult time as a single mother and did such a good job with me and my brother. The last person in the world I ever wanted to hurt was my mother. But I did, because I had to be true to myself. So I think that's what being brave or courageous is about.
What would you like your legacy to be?
Great question. Wow, that's a great question for any of your listeners to think about. I have thought a lot about this during COVID, because I began offering online writing workshops during COVID. I was going to offer them in my house. I had a whole plan. I was going to create intimate writing workshops in my home for people in Hamilton. And then COVID hit and I took it online. And you were one of the participants in my writing workshop and wrote a beautiful story, Linda. I've had hundreds of people participate. It is a huge joy for me to offer the 6-minute memoir online writing workshops. People write true stories from their life and share it in an intimate group setting. Often these stories are very profound, about love and loss and all the often difficult things in life, not always difficult. And I realize that my legacy, I think, is to not only tell my own story, but really to help other people birth their stories. It gives me so much joy to help them do that. And I do that now with my writing workshops. I have one-on-one memoir coaching, and I run the 6-minute memoir storytelling event in Hamilton, which is held a couple times a year, and 12 storytellers share a tale on a theme, and we have hundreds of people attend online. And I think that is my legacy. Most people, everybody has stories in them. What holds people back is fear that they're not good enough, that they can't write, and that no one will care. And those are all the things I felt when I wrote my memoir. Why would anyone care about my story? Can I really do this? And yes, you can. And for most people with the coaching, what they need is a deadline and an enthusiastic guide that tells them they can do it. That's what I aim to be for people. And there's strategies, there's writing tips, there's exercises that you can do to help people perfect their story. But we all have stories in us, and sometimes we just need permission and a coach to help us get them out on the page. And for many people, a deadline. There's nothing like the incentive of a deadline to make you get creative. And that's what I love to do with people. And it has been such a privilege to hear the heartfelt stories of people over the years, thousands of them. I launched a podcast in September, and it's once a month, the 6-minute memoir podcast. The first one was a story of a person who came out to their parents who were religious, and the fear of coming out and the joy of being accepted. And the second was a man who lost his wife of 40 years. They had a beautiful marriage. His grief was so profound, and he found love again. And the third one that just came out is a woman who's 84 years old, who writes about her terrible experience with a very profound postpartum depression 60 years ago that led her to have suicidal thoughts. So these people are brave and courageous, right? To put these kind of stories out there, these personal, revealing stories. But in my experience, it's so healing for people to share their stories because others respond to them. When we share the tough stuff of life and be vulnerable with each other, that's what brings meaning and closeness and understanding. When I can let you see me and you can let me see you, it creates healing and beauty in the world. And I think sharing our stories is just so important. And it just gives me great joy to be involved in helping people do that.
And it is on some level a spiritual practice to tap into your own stories, sharing with others that common understanding that happens between two people as a result of listening and sharing that moment. I can speak from experience of having been in the workshop that you show up at your Zoom call and you've got this nice selection of folks that are around the screen and you just think, okay, great. And then people start telling their stories and you think, oh my God. And it's so powerful. And as a listener to take those stories in and bear witness, if you will, it's profound and beautiful to experience as a both someone who's a writer and wants to share a story, but also to be on the receiving end of other people's gifts as storytellers. So thank you for doing that.
I love what you say about bearing witness, because not only do you get to tell your own story, but as you say, you learn from the stories of other people. And yes, we gather on Zoom. In prehistoric times, we gathered around the fire and did the exact same thing. Yes. We shared our stories. And in the digital age, it's harder to create community. People are so isolated. Loneliness is at an all-time high, especially during COVID. Zoom allows us to do some of these things, to have these workshops, to still create a sense of intimacy. And there's only 12 people in the group, and we do pledge confidentiality. So that also frees people up to speak their truth. And I really do feel like when that happens, it is a holy place. For me, often more holy than being in the church, seeing other humans share their wisdom, share their reflections, share their stories.
What would you do on your last day?
Well, I've actually thought about this because I have a chapter in my book. My book is divided into chapters by spiritual experiences. And one of my chapters is called Stopping for Death. I host a death over dinner. I pick up my own coffin. I visit the Green Cemetery where I hope to be buried. So I thought a lot about death, and one of my closest friends died last year. And so death has been very much on my mind. I'm very close to her family. I was very close to her. And losing someone you love, you become so aware of death and also so aware of life. I am alive today. She isn't. So I have thought about my last day, and I hope I'm old, and it will probably be cancer or something like that. And I do imagine myself in my own home having some choice over how I die. I hope MAID will be available to me, or that I will be able to choose the hour of my own death. Hopefully this will be true in 20 or 30 years. I'm 60 now, so say I live to 80. I really hope people have a choice over when they die. I would love to have a glass of champagne in my hand. I'd like to be listening to the Beatles. I'd like my pets to be on my bed, my children, my ex, my handful of close friends around my bed, holding my hand and telling me I can go. That's what I picture on my last day. And it's simple, isn't it? Simple. I don't have a desire to travel to some exotic land or accomplish some amazing feat. It's really about experiences and the people we love. That's a deep question. I'm not used to being interviewed. I'm used to being the one doing the interviewing. I've been a working journalist for 40 years and ask people all sorts of questions. So it's these are very, very good questions, and I welcome them. And it's interesting being on this side.
A couple of episodes ago, I spoke to a woman who's a death doula, and we talked about green burials, and it was such a great conversation to have about what is a good death. How do we define for ourselves what a good death is?
Such an important conversation to have. I hosted a couple of death dinners with a death doula during my year of living spiritually. I had 12 people around the table. It was kind of a loaves and fishes sort of meal. I had salmon and we broke bread and we drank wine and I had a bakery make a cake and a tombstone. And I had little skeletons, just heads, you know, from the dollar store. And I put every person's name on it as their place marker. And the death doula went around and we each talked about a death that was significant to us. We're all around 50 plus, so we've all experienced some kind of death. And we talked about what we wanted for our death. And she talked about things like green burials and home funerals and how it's all changing. And it was a very profound and spiritual experience. There were friends there I'd known for decades who told stories I didn't know about. My one friend I remember told a story about having to leave the nursing home when her father was dying, and she was ushered out because visiting hours were over and she wanted to stay. And that night her father died. And because of that death doula, I did visit the Green Cemetery and I did investigate home funerals. And I picked out a wicker coffin, $500. I took a picture of it, told my daughters that's what I wanted. I do not want them spending money at a funeral home. I hope you don't have a funeral home as a sponsor for this podcast. But, you know, people, children are in the most vulnerable state and then they're sold a package. How much did you love your mother? Let's get the $5,000 cherry coffin. No, I don't want that. They can have the money. So I would love to have a home funeral where they literally put my body on the dining room table, pack it with ice. Our friends can come and then they can go and bury it. You're allowed to do that at a green burial. I mean, we find it very off-putting and odd, but this is how it used to be before the funeral industry. People would place the body of their loved one in the parlor. That's where a funeral parlor, that's where the word comes from. People would bring food. The family would sit with the body. Now we just sweep it away. We sweep it away. We don't hold the body. We don't touch the body. And this is beginning to change. And studies show it's very healing for people when they can be with, even when our pets die, we hold them. The vet, we give them a needle. They go peacefully. We hold them. Why don't we do that with humans?
Oh, we're far more kind to our animals, you know, through euthanasia. That's the way I want to go. Right. When I'm done and my organs are shutting down and I've been through all the treatments and this and that, it's okay, let's just be done with this, shall we?
Yes.
Please let there be somebody kind enough to help me with that.
That's right. Yeah. They say death can be the last great spiritual experience if we can face it. There's so much we can do to keep a body artificially alive, that we can animate a body. And people will go to very extreme lengths just to stay alive, even if there's no quality of life. Quality of life is important. And that means different things to different people. But if we could choose for ourselves, I think that would be a blessing.
And if you had the opportunity to have a 5-minute conversation with someone living or dead, who would that be?
It probably would be my biological father. I always wanted to have a sense of him. What did his voice sound like? What does he look like? I know photos from old photos. Did he think about us when he left? I'm sure he did. I'm sure he felt we were better off without him. What did he like to do? You know, who was he? There's always a mystery. And people I know who are adopted or, you know, there's always this questioning about your parents. You know, we want to know. We have a right to know. And now I did a story on DNA testing. A lot of people are finding out secrets from their past. Their father was not who they thought their father was. And they, you know, are going on a mission to find that person because biology is important. Our DNA, we want to know. So my father was always a mystery man to me. And I would love to have the chance to solve a bit of that mystery. But that won't happen. And I'm okay with that now.
Is there anything else you wanted to share before we wrap up?
So I would really love to invite your listeners to check out my website, annebukma.com, Bukma with one O, and to consider working with me to tell your story, either in my workshop series in a small group or one-on-one. I would love to hear from you. And you can also subscribe to my monthly newsletter. I write a message every month and recommend memoirs to read and other things. Please consider doing that. I'd love to be in touch with any of your listeners. And thank you so much, Linda, for having me. Those really great questions, and it was a joy to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Well, speaking of joy, I thoroughly enjoyed your newsletter today, all about joy, and really appreciated the message at this time of year, and particularly as we're still in the dark days of the COVID pandemic and still not knowing where the end is. I believe that the end is in sight, but we've got a lot of time to pass yet.
Yeah, it's been a really difficult time for a lot of people, not knowing the pandemic fatigue, the new reality. And I know I have breezed through it, frankly, because I work from home. My life didn't really change. My life got a bit quieter, but that was a good thing. But for the very young and the very old, I think, my daughters, their education was affected, people not to be able to socialize with each other. And for the very old who often live alone and have become lonelier, very difficult for them. And not to sound trite in any way, but I find I try to, you know, one of the practices, the spiritual practices that stayed with me is gratitude, is to be intentionally grateful, because it's really easy to look at the things in our life that aren't going well. And everybody has stuff in their life that's not going well. Every single person. And that's not to deny that. But I really think there's so much also to be grateful for. Being alive, waking up in a cozy bed, having breakfast food, having a pet to walk, having a friend to talk to. You know, to be consciously grateful for those things, because so many people in the world don't have those things. And it, like I say, it's not to undermine the difficulties that people have, but I think if we can try to, and I don't want to be Pollyannish, and I have to remind myself of this often, look at all the things that are good. There's always something good.
I've been observing gratitude practices that are more, even more holistic, in the sense of being grateful for the things that are not going right, because they are an opportunity to learn and to grow and to evolve. And so that rather than trying to dig through the day and say, okay, great, I'm grateful for a warm bath, or I'm grateful for the comfy bed, I'm also grateful for the fact that guy cut me off on the expressway. And it gave me an opportunity to just check myself. I was driving too fast and I was being inattentive, and not turning it into a good, but acknowledging everything that is happening in your life and being grateful for all of it.
Yeah, I would say that would take an evolved person. I'm not quite there yet.
Yes, but, I know.
But like, it does.
Yes, I'm very grateful for that.
I've had challenges in my life and it has been difficult to be grateful for them. But usually afterwards I am, because growth does come from pain, as you know, in your own life. It takes a while to find the gratitude, because when we're in it, it just seems so bleak and hard. I think gratitude, they say, I think it was Cicero, or I can't remember. I've quoted in my book, the greatest spiritual practice that overrides any other is gratitude. Mm. And studies show that when you actually write things down that you're grateful for, it's good to rhyme them off in your head. But when you actually commit them to paper and keep a running tally, it leaves a mark. And on those days, I have an app on my phone, the Happy Tapper Gratitude app, where I enter 5 things a day. And honestly, they're very simple. It might be the Earl Grey tea in the morning that I look forward to, or sometimes it's a bigger thing. But I have thousands of these things on my phone now, because it keeps a running tally. And on those down days, which I have like everybody else, I look at them and I can see that this too shall pass, and there's a lot to be grateful for. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest takeaway I would say I have from that year, is that I am more grateful. And I think with gratitude comes a bit more patience as well.
Mm. Thank you so much for all your time, Anne, and for sharing your experiences and your thoughts.
Oh, thanks so much, Linda. I really appreciate talking to you and wish you all the best.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Richard Wagamese is a favorite author of Anne's and mine. He died just over 5 years ago on March 10th, 2017. Richard was an Ojibwe journalist and prolific author. He is perhaps best known for his novel, Indian Horse. Anne often shares this quote during her workshops. And given our conversation today, it seems appropriate to share it with you. All that we are is story. From the moment we are born to the time we continue on our spirit journey, we are involved in the creation of the story of our time here. It is what we arrive with. It is all we leave behind. We are not the things we accumulate. We are not the things we deem important. We are story, all of us. What comes to matter, then, is the creation of the best possible story we can while we're here. You, me, us, together. When we can do that, and we take the time to share those stories with each other, we get bigger inside. We see each other. We recognize our kinship. We change the world, one story at a time. I will share a link to Anne's website, where you can find information about her book, workshops, and the 6-Minute Memoir event. I highly recommend them all. Until next time, my name is Linda McLaughlin in the arena.